All right, so get this. We're going to do a deep dive into how machines like actually learn the meaning of words.
It's pretty wild. It's like giving computers a crash course in understanding human language.
But like no vocab lists or grammar rules.
No, this is way cooler. We're talking about math.
Math to understand words. Okay, I am intrigued. Tell me more.
So we're going to use your NLP course lesson and a chapter from Speech and Language Processing by Jurofsky and Martin.
Okay, so like real deal NLP stuff.
Oh yeah, the real deal. And we'll break it down into bite-sized pieces so you can ace that exam.
Perfect. That's what I need. All right, so let's start with I guess the very basics. Like, how do words carry meaning in the first place?
Well, that's lexical semantics.
Lexical semantics, got it. Write it down, everyone.
And one of the first things to be clear on is the difference between a lemma and a word form.
Ooh, okay, hit me with it.
A lemma is like the dictionary form of a word like run,
Okay, run.
but a word form is like all the different versions of that word, like running or ran.
So it's like the word's wearing different outfits, but it's still the same word underneath.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what happens when one word has multiple meanings?
Oh, like bank.
Exactly. Is it the place where you keep your money or like the side of a river?
Right. So tricky. How do computers figure that out?
Well, that's word sense disambiguation. Your exam might ask about different approaches to
Oh,
that.
yeah, for sure. It's like the computer has to be a detective to figure out which meaning is the right one.
Precisely. Now let's talk about relationships between words.
Okay, bring on the relationships.
So we have synonyms like happy and joyful words that mean almost the same thing.
Almost the same thing. There's got to be a catch.
There is. It's called the principle of contrast. Even small wording differences can change the meaning a little bit.
Right, like cheap versus inexpensive. One sounds kind of judgmental.
Exactly. And then there's word similarity, which is a little broader.
Broader how?
Think cat and dog, not synonyms, but they share a lot of characteristics.
Four legs furry, make good pets.
Yeah. Then there's word relatedness, which is about words that are connected through events or belong to the same topic.
Like doctor and hospital.
Exactly. Different meanings, but definitely related. It's all connected.
Wow, so words have this whole web of relationships. Okay, but how do we teach a computer about all of this?
That's where vector semantics comes in.
Vector semantics, hit me with it.
It's a way to represent word meaning using vectors. It's all inspired by this guy Osgood and the distributional hypothesis.
Okay, I am so ready to learn about this because this is like the heart of how computers understand meaning, right?
Exactly. So imagine we're taking those complex relationships between words and turning them into math.
Like a secret code that computers can read.
Exactly. And one of the tools we use is a co-occurrence matrix.
Ooh, that sounds fancy. What is that?
It's basically a table that shows how often words appear together.
So, like, if Pete and Gunnar always hangs out together, they get a high score.
You got it. It could be words in documents or just words near each other. We can do it either way.
And that's how computers learn the meaning, right? By seeing which words hang out together.
Exactly. The distributional hypothesis in action.
Okay, so for example, if we see football hang out with goal and stadium, we can guess it's about sports.
Precisely. And then each word becomes a point in a multidimensional space.
Whoa, multidimensional. Now you're just showing off.
Not really. It's how we create embeddings, which are these mathematical representations of the words.
So, like, instead of thinking about words as just letters, we think about them as points in space, and where they are tells us about their meaning.
Exactly. And similar documents, they end up clustering together in this space. It's really cool to see.
It's like a map of language, but like a really complicated map.
That's a great way to think about it. Now, to measure how similar two word vectors are, we use cosine similarity.
Cosine similarity. Okay, I know this is important, but break it down for me.
Basically, imagine two vectors each representing a word. Cosine similarity is all about the angle between them. Smaller angle means more similar.
So it's like a compass pointing us towards similar words.
Perfect analogy. And to calculate it, we use something called the dot product, which is a way of multiplying vectors.
Dot product. Got it. But why can't we just use like how often the words appear? That seems simpler.
Good question. So raw word frequencies, they favor common words like the, which aren't that helpful for figuring out the meaning.
Yeah, true. The doesn't tell us much. So what do we do?
We need to balance frequency with how unique a word is. That's where TF-IDF comes in.
EFIDF. I know I've seen that before. It stands for something, right?
It stands for term frequency inverse document frequency. Term frequency is how often a word appears in a document.
Okay, makes sense. What about that inverse document frequency part?
It gives more weight to words that are specific to certain documents and less weight to common words that appear everywhere.
So, like, if we're analyzing news articles, the appears everywhere, so it's not that interesting. But election only appears in political articles, so it's more important.
Exactly. We're filtering out the noise to focus on the important words.
Makes sense. Okay, so we've got these tools to measure relationships between words. I'm starting to get how computers can learn about meaning.
That's great. And remember, these are all building blocks for even more advanced stuff, which we'll get to next time.
Oh, I can't wait. But first, tell me, how do we actually create these word embeddings?
One way is with an algorithm called Word2Vec.
Word2Vec, it sounds so cool. What makes it special?
It creates these dense embeddings, which are short vectors packed with info.
Why is dense better?
They generalize better to new words and contexts, and they're way easier for computers to work with.
Got it. So what's the secret behind Word2Vec?
It uses a technique called skipgram with negative sampling. We train a classifier to predict if a word is likely to appear near a target word.
So it's like figuring out which words are best friends.
Exactly. And the cool thing is we don't need any special labeled data, just running text.
Wait, so we can train a classifier without any labels? That sounds impossible.
It's called self-supervision. So if a word is near our target word that's a positive example, then we randomly pick other words to be negative examples.
So we're showing the classifier the BFFs and the random strangers.
Yeah. And the weights the classifier learns become our word embeddings.
It's like a patch-making service for words. So cool.
And the classifier estimates the probability of a word being a true context word based on how similar its embedding is to the target word's embedding.
The closer the embeddings, the more likely they are to be friends, right?
You got it. We use the dot product and this thing called the sigmoid function to make it all work.
Dot product again. Okay, I am definitely seeing the importance of math now.
It's all about finding those hidden connections between words.
This is mind-blowing. So now we have this incredible multi-dimensional space with words mapped out. But how can we even visualize that?
That's a great question. It can be tough to visualize high-dimensional stuff. One way is to list the most similar words based on their closeness in the embedding space.
Okay, so like showing the word's closest neighbors.
Right. We can also use hierarchical clustering, which groups words together based on their relationships. Or we can use projection methods like TSNE, which can flatten it down to 2D so we can actually see it.
So like taking a 3D model and making it a 2D picture, we lose some detail, but we can still see the overall structure.
Exactly. And these visualizations can be super helpful for seeing those connections between words.
I bet there will be visualizations on the exam for sure.
You bet. Okay, so now we're starting to understand how embeddings can unlock the hidden structure of language. But context window size, that plays a big role too, right?
Yeah, I remember we talked about that. What's the deal with context window size?
So it determines how many words we consider when we're calculating those co-occurrences. Smaller windows capture more about grammar, like which words function in similar ways.
So like running and jumping are both action verbs.
Exactly. Longer windows, they capture more about the topic, like which words belong to the same semantic field.
Okay, so a longer window would show us that running is also related to marathon and shoes.
Exactly. It's like zooming out to get the bigger picture.
Got it. Now, what was that about first order and second order co-occurrence?
First order is when words appear right next to each other, like peanut and butter. Second order is when words share similar neighbors, even if they don't appear right next to each other.
So like coffee and tea might have second order co-occurrence because they both hang out with words like drink and hot.
You got it. It's like they have mutual friends, even though they haven't met directly.
Love it. Okay, so we've covered how to measure relationships between words and how to create embeddings. I'm starting to feel a lot more confident about this exam.
That's great to hear. And remember, this is just the beginning. We'll dive into even more cool stuff next time, like how embeddings can capture those A is to B as C is to D analogies.
Oh, yeah. I remember you mentioning that. I can't wait to hear more about that.
It's going to be awesome. So stay tuned for the next part of our deep dive.
Sounds good. I will definitely be there.
Welcome back. Ready for more vector semantics fun?
Oh, yeah. I'm excited to hear more about how those embeddings can do those analogy things like A is to B as C is to D.
You got it. So remember those relationships between words? We can actually map those out in vector space. It's like a geometric approach to language.
So instead of just logic puzzles, we're using math to find the connections.
Exactly. And this is super useful for all sorts of NLP tasks, question answering, machine translation, even creative writing.
Wow. Okay. I am definitely paying attention to this. This could be on the exam for sure.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And remember how we talked about tracking changes in word meaning over time?
Yeah, that sounded super interesting, like seeing how words evolve.
Exactly. So imagine we create embeddings from different time periods. We could actually see how a word like cool has changed from the 1950s to now.
That is so cool. It's like a time machine for words. We can see how they gain new meanings and even change their vibes over time.
You got it. And this can help us understand cultural shifts, social trends, even how people talk about politics. For example, researchers have used this to track how gender stereotypes and jobs have changed.
That's amazing. We're using word embeddings to uncover the hidden stories behind language. It's like words are constantly changing and adapting to the world around them.
Exactly. Now, remember how we talked about word sense disambiguation, like figuring out which meaning of bank is meant?
Yeah, the river bank versus the money bank. Always a classic.
So there's this technique called word sense induction that uses context to figure out which meaning is most likely.
So the algorithm has to look at the surrounding words for clues.
Right, like if bank is hanged out with words like money and loan, it's probably the financial kind. But if it's near river and water, well, you get the idea.
Makes sense. It's all about those subtle hints that tell us what's really going on.
Exactly. And the more data we have, the better these algorithms get at solving those word sense puzzles.
Okay, so we've talked about individual word meanings, but how do those meanings combine to make sense at the phrase or sentence level?
Ah, that's compositional semantics.
Compositional semantics, got it. Is that like putting words together like Legos to build something bigger?
You got it. Each word is a brick, and how they're put together creates the overall meaning.
So it's not just about understanding each word separately, but how they interact with each other.
Exactly. And there are different ways to model this in NLP. One way is with vector composition models.
Vector composition models. Okay, tell me more.
The simplest way is to just add the vectors together. Like for red apple, we might add the vectors for red and apple.
So we're literally combining the meanings by adding the vectors together. Does that really work?
Sometimes. But it can get more complicated when we have more complex relationships between the words. So researchers have come up with more sophisticated composition functions that take into account word order, grammar, and even semantic relationships.
So we're not just mixing words randomly. We're carefully crafting their interactions to create meaning.
That's a great way to put it. One technique that's becoming popular is using recursive neural networks.
Recursive neural networks, those sound intense. What are those all about?
They can handle those hierarchical structures in language, like representing phrases and sentences as trees. By combining embeddings up the tree, we can capture those intricate relationships between words.
It's like creating a family tree for a sentence, tracing the lineage of meaning from individual words to the overall message.
Exactly. And remember those attention mechanisms we talked about. They allow models to focus on the most important words in a sentence.
Oh yeah, like giving the model a highlighter to mark the key parts.
Right. This has been a game changer for tasks like machine translation and text summarization.
This is also fascinating. It's like we're giving computers a crash course in linguistics, teaching them to read between the lines and understand the nuances of human language.
And it keeps getting more advanced. Now we're exploring contextualized embeddings. These allow words that have different meanings depending on the context.
So words are like chameleons. They change their meaning depending on who they're with.
Exactly. Contextualized embeddings have led to major breakthroughs in NLP. But even with all these advances, we're still just scratching the surface of how humans understand language.
So what are some of the things that vector semantics still struggles with? Where does it fall short?
That's a great question, and it's important to be aware of these limitations. One big challenge is common sense knowledge. Humans use their experience of the world to understand language, but computers don't have that.
So, like, if I tell a computer I put the book on the shelf, it might not understand that the book is now resting on the shelf.
Right. Vector semantics is mostly about patterns in text, not the physical world those words represent.
And it's not just physical stuff. It's also hard to represent abstract ideas like justice or freedom with vectors.
Exactly. And then there are things like humor, sarcasm, cultural references. Those are really hard for computers to grasp.
So we're still a long way from computers truly understanding language like humans do. But we're making progress.
Definitely. And that's what makes this field so exciting. There's still so much to explore and discover.
I'm ready for whatever comes next, but first I think I need to review all of this for the exam.
That's a great idea. And remember to think critically about what we've discussed. Don't just memorize definitions. Think about the strengths and limitations of these approaches.
Great advice. Okay, so we've covered a ton of ground in this deep dive. I feel like I have a much better grasp on how machines are learning to understand language.
That's great to hear. And remember, this is just the beginning of your journey into the world of vector semantics. There's a whole universe of language and computation out there waiting to be explored.
Okay, so we're back for the final part of our vector semantics deep dive. And I gotta say, I'm feeling way more prepared for that exam now.
That's great to hear. We've hit all the major points, like how computers learn word meanings, those relationships between words, even how meaning works at the sentence level.
Yeah, it's been intense. But like, are we missing anything? Are there things vector semantics just isn't good at?
That's a really important question. And knowing the weaknesses of a tool is just as crucial as understanding its strengths.
So like, where does it fall short?
Well, one major area is common sense knowledge.
Oh yeah, computers don't exactly have real world experience, right?
Exactly, they don't. So while they can pick up patterns in text, they might miss the underlying meaning that humans just get.
So if I tell a computer I close the door, it might not understand that the door is now blocking the entrance.
That's the challenge. They haven't experienced closing a door or feeling the breeze stop.
It's like those capture tests where you have to identify real world objects Computers still struggle with that kind of stuff.
Right, and it's not just physical things. Abstract ideas like freedom or justice are also tricky to represent with vectors.
Yeah, how do you even map those onto a point in space?
It's tough, and then there's humor, sarcasm, cultural nuances. All those things humans understand effortlessly, but computers often miss.
So how do we know if these models are actually capturing the right information? How do we evaluate them?
Great question. There are two main approaches, intrinsic and extrinsic evaluation. Intrinsic is about how well the model captures word relationships internally, like those analogies we discussed.
Right. So using datasets like WordSim 353 to see if the model's idea of word similarity matches up with human judgments.
Exactly. But then only half the story. Extrinsic evaluation is about how well these embeddings actually improve performance on real-world tasks.
So, like, does using these embeddings lead to better sentiment analysis or machine translation?
You got it. It's about seeing how well the model can actually use what it's learned.
So intrinsic is like testing the model's knowledge, and extrinsic is seeing if it can apply that knowledge in the real world.
Perfect analogy. Now remember, even with the best algorithms, results can vary due to randomness in the training process.
Right, so it's important to do multiple runs and maybe even use techniques like bootstrap sampling to get a more reliable picture.
Exactly. Showing that you understand these nuances will really impress your professor.
Okay, I'm making a note of that. This is all super helpful. I feel like I've gained a whole new appreciation for the complexities of language and how computers are trying to make sense of it all.
That's fantastic to hear. And remember, this is just the beginning of your journey into NLP. There's always more to learn and explore.
Well, thanks to this deep dive, I feel like I have a solid foundation to build on. To our listener out there, good luck on that exam.
You got this. And remember, keep that curiosity alive. There's a whole world of language and computation out there waiting to be discovered. 700,000 gel.